My guest today, Professor Nikolai Petro, has a long and distinguished record in the field of Russian and Ukraine studies, about which I can best only tell you a little. After receiving his BA, MA, and PhD in Foreign Affairs from the University of Virginia in 1984, Professor Petro founded the Center for Contemporary Russian Studies at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey. In 1989 and 1990, as an International Affairs Fellow of the Council of Foreign Relations, he served as Special Assistant for Policy in the Office of Soviet Union Affairs at the State Department and as Temporary Political Attaché at the Embassy in Moscow. While in the Soviet Union, he monitored local elections in Russia, Belarus, and Latvia. In 2001 and 2002, he returned to Russia as a private citizen to serve as staff consultant to the Inadmissible Research and Training Center Dialogue and advisor to the mayor of the Russian city of Novgorod the Great. His postdoctoral awards include two Fulbrights, one to Russia and one to Ukraine, a Thornton D. Hooper International Affairs Fellowship at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, and research awards from the National Council for Eurasian and East European Research, the Kennan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies in Washington, and the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He has written a half dozen books and numerous articles on Russia and Ukraine, and will be the guest editor of a special issue of European Politics and Society to be out next month entitled Ukraine in Crisis, which is a subject we'll explore today. It's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Nikolai Petro to Takes on the World.
Hello. Yeah.
Very glad to have you here. I want to begin by asking you to tell our listeners about an important event that took place 2 years ago, last May 2nd, following the U.S.-supported coup in Ukraine that most Americans know nothing about, a terrorist attack by right-wing Ukraine nationalists on a trade union office in Odessa that killed 48 workers and wounded another 200, which you described in an article on Counterpunch this past April 28th.
So this is one of the key events of the new Ukraine, marking sort of the transition between the old regime and the new policies of the new government. As you mentioned, May 2nd, 2014, there was a confrontation between radicals who came into the city from other regions and local activists mostly from Odessa. Clashes took place in the center of the city and then moved from the center of the city to the area downtown where the trade union building is. And after storming and getting rid of a tent city that had been set up there, and forcing the activists to flee into the trade union building, it was firebombed by Molotov cocktails, resulting in the deaths of at least 48 people and scores of injured. This event is under investigation. There have been a lot of commissions set up in Ukraine to investigate it, but there has been no progress to date on finding out who is responsible or bringing anyone to justice. And this is one of the big frustrations, I would say, particularly in the Novgorod region, with the current government and with law enforcement in general. So last year there was a commemoration, peaceful commemoration of this event, trying to push for some sort of investigation. this year, no commemoration was allowed. What happened was that the main square in front of the trade union building was occupied by the police, and no one was allowed to enter it on the date, on the time set for the commemoration. Local judges had allowed a commemoration to take place, but the police prevented it, arguing that there was bomb threats, and there were bomb threats throughout the day. And in addition, the rest of the city was basically put on lockdown by having an additional 3,000 to 3,500 National Guard troops brought into the city. And as a result, partly of these measures, and partly, I think, of the common sense of many Odessans who didn't want any confrontation with authorities or any confrontation that would get out of hand, the situation was quite peaceful, even though the commemorations were prevented. The interesting thing about this particular date is that it falls within a week of what many Ukrainians and people throughout the former Soviet Union consider one of their major national holidays, which is Victory Day of Soviet forces in Europe, which is May 9th. So this, too, since it occurs so close to May 2nd, becomes a time when people rally to explain their discomfort with the attempts of the current regime to rewrite history and to sever the traditionally close relations between Ukraine and Russia.
What is remarkable is the lack of coverage this event received in the mainstream media at the time. And even the Los Angeles Times wrote that there were snipers inside the building, as if the people, the victims, were the ones who were the perpetrators.
Well, we don't know. The Los Angeles Times can't honestly or legitimately say that because we don't have any official findings. As I said, there have been three commissions locally and two commissions in the parliament, but both the Council of Europe and the United Nations rapporteur have pointed out that there has been no conclusion to the official investigation, no data released. The responsibility for the investigation was transferred from the Odessa region to Kiev, and only last month, after they did nothing to promote the investigation in Kiev, did they send it back to Odessa. And the very first public press conference by the chief police officer in charge took place 2 weeks ago to answer questions about how the investigation was proceeding, and basically to tell everybody that they'd really just begun the investigation. But in the meantime, a lot of the information, as several analysts have noted who are familiar with this incident, a lot of material has been lost, a lot of material has been designated as secret. So there are a variety of conspiracy theories, and it's unfortunate that some of these conspiracy theories become then related as, well, this is what actually happened, even in reputable Western news outlets.
Well, it is, for me, as I say, bewildering, because I tell you, Frank, when I read your article, and I have been following the situation in Ukraine, I thought closely. I did not remember it. I confess I did not remember it. And this was a major event. And if ISIL had done it, it would have been all over the headlines of the Western press. Or if it had been done by some outfit that the United States puts on its terrorist list. But I find that even the coverage of the events taking place in Maidan during the protest and before the overthrow of Yanukovych, that the role of these ultra-right nationalists had been played down. And one of the things I've noticed since this time, for other reasons, but the rise of the ultra-right throughout Europe. And wonder if you see the connections between this, what we have in Ukraine and what we have in Hungary, Austria, other countries like that.
I don't know enough about the character of right-wing or nationalist movements in other countries to make a comparison. What I can say is that, in my opinion, nationalist groups, and I would go so far as to call them radical nationalists, because as opposed to people that one might colloquially designate as patriots, these people whom I call radical nationalists specifically focus on removing Russian influence from Ukrainian culture, language, culture, tourist ties, literature, not political pressure, not economic, but really trying to sever any kind of connection. And in order to do that, they have to promote a view of Russia as the antithesis of everything that is Ukrainian. And Ukrainian is good, and therefore everything that Russia is or stands for, any Russian, any person speaking the Russian language, it doesn't matter if you're Ukrainian or not, that in and of itself makes you a potential traitor to their cause. So it's a really Manichaean black and white view of the world. And these groups have elected officials in the parliament. They exert an inordinate influence, not proportionate to their numbers, but much greater than the relatively small number of elected officials they have in the parliament, because they are a very vocal, very aggressive group, and their prominence, their influence in the political system, I believe, is one of the reasons that Ukraine has backed away from implementing the Minsk peace accords. Because on the one hand, the government seems to have signed these accords, now more than a year old, but it has been unable to consistently implement the steps within them, which are very clear, because to do so would provoke the anger of these radical groups, many of which are armed, they have their own militias. They act independently, or they promise to act independently, in any case, of the official forces of law and order. So they constitute a law unto themselves. And this is very, very dangerous, I think, for the political stability and ultimately for any aspirations Ukraine may have to integrate into the European legal and political system.
Well, you wrote an earlier article in March I found quite interesting, Why Ukraine Needs Russia More Than Ever, that its economic survival depends on its relations with Russia. And I recall before Yanukovych was overthrown that Vladimir Putin had offered Ukraine a much better deal in terms of a loan, no interest loan, I believe it was, of $15 billion, to take care temporarily of Ukraine's terrible economic situation. But he, the Ukrainians and then Poroshenko elected to go with a much stiffer deal, much more difficult arrangement, more expensive arrangement with the European Union. And now today, the Ukrainian economy is crumbling. Perhaps you comment on that.
Well, the interesting fact about the Ukrainian economic statistics is that after a policy of trying to sever economic ties, of promoting independence on every possible arena with respect to Russia. Russia remains Ukraine's single largest trading partner. And I just took that fact and reminded readers of it and said, well, how is this country going to prosper if it doesn't have mutually beneficial trade relations with its much larger and much wealthier neighbor? It would be like Canada saying, well, we don't want to trade with the United States because of, you know, all the bad things that America wants to do to us. No Canadian government official could pursue such a policy because it would make everything in the Canadian economy that much more expensive. But this, to me, since this similar policy in Ukraine, really, to me, highlights the ideological nature of what they're trying to accomplish. They're trying to promote an economic policy that is not in the actual best interests of the Ukrainian consumer, but is oriented toward creating a rift with Russia that can never be healed. And this is something that really the EU, which would, you know, would like Ukraine to be prosperous and independent of Russia and would like to be able to have good ties with it, this is not something that the EU thinks is rational. It's willing to support Ukraine for some time, but really, in the long run, there is no alternative but to have good trade and economic relations and hopefully diplomatic and political relations with your biggest neighbor. Any other approach seems to me very nearsighted and counterproductive.
Well, one thing that occurred to me is seeing the relative neglect that now Ukraine has the mainstream media, even from our politicians, that whether intentional or not, the confrontation that followed when Putin had the vote in Crimea and then annexed it and brought it back into the Russian sphere served to pump up what seemed to be a North American North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, that had run out of reasons for existing. Now it's flexing its muscles, and the Ukraine confrontation with Russia has given a NATO new life.
Yes. Well, NATO had a difficult rationale for its existence as a military bloc if it wasn't doing anything militarily. So NATO has always had two components. One is a civilian diplomatic component, which includes things like, you know, cultural exchanges and things like that. But a lot of that is duplicated by other European institutions and some transatlantic institutions like the Atlantic Council. But the thing that has always set NATO apart from other institutions, it was a military pact. And the rationale for its creation was to serve as a defensive deterrent against Soviet aggression. So when the Soviet pact that was set up later than NATO, 6 years later, the Warsaw Pact disbanded, the rationale for NATO as a military organization became unclear. So among the NATO constituencies, among the NATO lobby groups, I think the interpretation, the narrative that what Russia is doing is a war of aggression in Ukraine, which is changing the status quo in Europe, is very handy for the military side of NATO, which we can look at the trends in expenditures has been declining. Now, for the very first time, I hear, the German military will be expanding in size. A number of countries whose percentage of GNP spent on the military had fallen to less than 2% are at least considering the possibility of raising it to 2%. As long as that narrative of a aggressive Russia can be preserved in the public mind, there will be support for this kind of expenditure. I think in the long run, though, it's not likely to be preserved because people asking themselves about how to spend taxpayers' money in places like Holland or France or even Finland and Sweden look at their options and say, okay, well, let's say Russia was aggressive and is conducting an aggressive war, and we have Crimea as an example, and then we look at Donbass in the eastern Ukraine, and there's clearly some level of involvement and support in something that we call a hybrid war. But why isn't there more? In other words, there seems to have been a freezing of the conflict once specific objectives were obtained. So now the question becomes for NATO, well, what are we doing? Are we preventing further aggression? But where's the proof of the further aggression? Or are we? Is our expenditure aimed at pushing Russia back, taking the fight to Russia, and liberating eastern Ukraine and Crimea? No. That's clearly not the objective, say, politicians and NATO members. So we seem to not have a clear strategy as to what this additional expenditure is designed exactly to accomplish. And I would say the same thing is true for our policy on sanctions. Our sanctions policy is aimed to send a message. Okay, well, how long does it take to send a message to Russia? 2 years? Are we still sending the same message? Well, then that wasn't a very effective message if they haven't gotten it in 2 years. It really makes very little sense, which is why I think you have some very notable people in the United States, for example, not to mention Europe, but former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, former U.S. Defense Secretary William Perry, and even some presidential candidates saying that, well, we need to sit down with Russia, with the Russian leadership, and have a clear discussion and try to get over our differences and set our relations on a better course than they have been these last 2 years.
My guest is Professor Nikolai Petro, and we are talking about the situation now in Russia and Ukraine. One thing that seems to me, in looking at the whole situation, is that the United States was essentially following the neocon agenda in its approach toward Russia, which still sees Russia as an old Soviet Union and the Cold War, and that simply they want to maintain this kind of confrontation standing. And the American public is really not even a part of this conversation. That they're frightened. They keep seeing words like Russian aggression, Russian invasion of Ukraine. But these seems to be, at the very minimum, an out-of-hand exaggeration. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the neocon role in this? If you have to comment on that.
I guess I see the logic of saying that in the absence of a policy that can envision, that can even imagine Russia as a friend of the West. It is natural for our relations to fall back to the familiar traditional patterns of hostility. So we've had 25 years since the collapse of communism. And at the time, at least when I was in school, I remember being told that our enmity was not with Russia and the Russian people, or their values, but with the communist system. So that, logically, if the communist system were ended, then our values would lead us to closer interaction and a new type of relationship. But unfortunately, that never took hold. We simply had a generation of people, and that's the same generation that we still have running for president, including, for example, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and even Bernie Sanders. These are all people for whom Russia is the Soviet Union. I mean, they have no other language through which to describe the country that they grew up being told was their enemy because of the communist system. Now, the communist system has been dead and buried for a long time, but because information about Russia focuses on everything that tends to be negative about it, it's not at all clear that they're able to come up with an alternative perception of Russia. And before we can have a new policy, we have to be able to understand how much the country has changed. And until we get that message through the media, well, we have what is in essence a self-fulfilling prophecy with our foreign policy. We see the enemy we want to see.
Now, it's interesting that one of your articles, the first article, was on Counterpunch, and the article on why Ukraine needs Russia more than ever was on London Guardian.
Right.
How open is the U.S. mainstream media to hearing another viewpoint?
Well, there are editorial positions which seem to me very clearly delineated in major outlets. Having said that, it has been my experience that if one has a point of contact within the establishment, one can approach that person, and if that person sees you as reasonable and is open to the idea that there could be a different point of view, they could potentially publish something that you write. But it is to write, say, for the to send off an article to the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times just with a novel idea or novel interpretation without doing the careful legwork of making sure that it gets to the right person in the editorial staff, that that person knows you, that that person knows of your credentials, that's basically futile. I wrote these kind of op-ed pieces and sent them off, for example, to the Washington Post for 20 years and never got any insight. But once I met people on the editorial board of other major American newspapers, then they simply take you see you as a viable alternative, and there may be room for alternative points of view occasionally. But the amount of press that someone with the view that Russia is not entirely at fault or that they have a point of view that I might get, or that someone much more distinguished than I in the field of Russian studies or Soviet studies could get, like a Stephen Cohen, has been sharply reduced because unfamiliar arguments cannot be easily processed. I think that's the way I would explain it. If you start with a very different premise about what the problem is, what the solution is, you know, it's like arguing about creationism at a convention of scientists. You know, it's like you're on a very different planet, and there's just simply no way to take your arguments at face value, no matter what your academic credentials are.
Well, it is interesting, though, is that it seems, and I grew up during the World War II and the Cold War, that this particular group of characters called the neocons were working behind the scenes. I mentioned earlier, but I played 2 years ago the recordings of Victoria Nuland's husband, Kagan. Robert Kagan is the founder of the Project for New American Century, was already endorsed to Hillary Clinton. I played her speech to the Ukrainian American Foundation, which she bragged about the billions the U.S. had already spent on trying to change the government of Ukraine, and then the conversation that was recorded with the ambassador, Jeff Pyatt, about their plans for post-coup Ukraine and how she picked Yatsenyuk to be the prime minister, and that's who he turned out to be. It sounds like a board game, which the Ukrainians were just chess pieces or on the board for some other outside party's benefit. And now that Ukraine essentially done, it's pushed to the side, and yet they've left something behind there that, as you describe it, is getting uglier by the minute.
Well, their American involvement in and EU involvement in the political process of Ukraine and its administration is far from over. It's one of those things that is widely discussed in the Ukrainian press, and it's basically taken for granted that there is an American or an EU curator in pretty much every administrative office in Ukraine and the Ukrainian government. But the perspective, why this is desirable or necessary, I mean, there are arguments that you call them neocons. They can be called cold warriors. I suppose people like that would define themselves as American exceptionalists. You remember Madeleine Albright's famous statement that America does intervene aggressively throughout the world because of its special character, because we see farther than other nations what their true interests are. And if you take that point of view as your point of departure about the unique beneficence of America and American foreign policy, then what you're doing is a happy, in foreign countries like Ukraine, is a happy coincidence between things that support or advantage American foreign policy, but also in the long run will help Ukrainians. And those who see it as foreign intervention are simply unenlightened about their own best interests. It's not something that you can sort of discuss on the level of practical rationality, but rather it becomes a debate over visions of the world which has very messianic and religious overtones about America's mission to the world. So I would be wary.
Very frightening
politicians
prospect.
Who adopt
yes.
this.
Yes, I'm. In watching our two candidates, indeed, Trump is all over the place, but Madam Clinton seems actually ready to go on the first day with a no-fly zone over Syria and has learned nothing from her previous forays into Libya and elsewhere.
And I would expect that because of her much vaunted experience, she is actually very much settled in her ways. If you read some of the critiques, there have been some excellent critiques of her foreign policy out there by Andrew Bacevich Jr., by Anatole Levin, a famous article called "The Hawk Named Hillary." We know essentially what her foreign policy would be. The only, aside from leaving aside Senator Sanders, who doesn't look like he will be the candidate, the most likely Republican nominee, Donald Trump, is a much more of an uncertainty. People seem to be able to read into his views and his statements whatever they want to hear. And even people who have a desire for improving relations with Russia can look at his foreign his few foreign policy statements and take comfort from those views, because they are indeed not as settled and at least appear to display a bit more flexibility and originality in the interpretation of American interests than those of former Secretary of State Clinton.
And at that point, interesting point, we have so much to look forward to or not look forward to. I want to thank you very much, Professor Nikolai Petro, for being our guest on Takes on the World. And you have a website, NikolaiPetro.com, correct?
www.npetro.net.
Dot net.
Right.
Okay.
NPETRO.net.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.